Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. It has been, in many ways, a campaign season of anger and gloom, of candidates saying America is in trouble, rigged, rotten, going to hell. If you read the polls, a lot of Americans seem to agree. Atlantic writer James Fallows just spent 3 years traveling 54,000 miles across the country, visiting more than 50 cities and towns, and he's come to a different conclusion. Yes, there are problems, but there is a lot of resilience out there too, he says. Communities rebuilding, reinventing themselves right now. This hour On Point, a firsthand report on sources of American strength. Tap into the campaign almost anywhere. Here was January, North Charleston, South Carolina. Donald Trump, is he angry?
Our military is a disaster. Our health care is a horror show. Obamacare, we're going to repeal it and replace it. We have no borders. Our vets are being treated horribly. Illegal immigration is beyond belief. Our country is being run by incompetent people. And yes, I am angry.
And is it just Republican gloom? Here's Hillary Clinton Saturday night after her victory in Nevada.
We look at our country and see so much that isn't working the way it should. We see grandparents forced to choose between paying rent and buying medicine. We see African-American families denied mortgages at nearly three times the rate of white families. We see small towns and rural communities hollowed out by lost jobs and lost hope. We see a rising generation of young people coming of age in a world where opportunity seems out of reach.
Okay, let's get another view or see how it stacks up to what we hear on the trail anyway. Joining me now from Greenville, South Carolina, is James Fallows. He is a national correspondent for The Atlantic and has spent the last 3 years on an extended reporting trip, let's say, to dozens of cities and towns across America. James Fallows, welcome back to One Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Great nice to talk to you.
It's wonderful to have you. So, I've known you for a long time. I know you're a flyer. Everybody knows you love flying. You've hopped in that plane with your wife, Deb. You have hit a lot of locations in this country. And are you really here to tell us that the doom and gloom and anger on the campaign trail has got it all wrong? There's a different America out there?
I'm here to tell you that in most parts of the country, you'll hear the following conversation. Part one, things in America are just going to hell. That's what we hear in the news. That's what we hear from the politicians. The country's falling apart. Part two, things here in Mississippi or South Carolina or South Dakota or Fresno or Allentown or Eastport, Maine or whatever are moving in a positive direction. And that is, all the problems we know about exist, but most people think that the part of America within their own knowledge is actually moving forward rather than back.
Does that mean, are you here to say that the national candidates for the presidency have it wrong, that their supporters who believe and buy and are acting on, whether it's Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump or Marco Rubio or Hillary Clinton, that they misunderstand that the country has a slate of problems and is headed in some rough directions?
I believe to say, number one, that we are indeed in a second Gilded Age, and all the problems of the first Gilded Age of polarization and inequality and politicized judiciary and all the rest, we do have those. Number two, that the especially Republican Party and Trump exaggerations about how the U.S. stands relative to the rest of the world are just fantastical. I mean, there is no country whose overall situation you would prefer to that of the United States, notwithstanding all of our problems. You know, China has a million more than you. But, and number three, that there is more of a forward rather than backward trend that people are finding ways to respond to these challenges in a fashion that's not really reflected in a lot of the national level political fire and brimstone.
I promise you, I want to get to what you found when you touched down in all these cities. But let me just put one more wave of resistance against the broad approach. Two-thirds of Americans, again and again in recent years, say the country is adrift. Strong majorities say the country is on the wrong track. Do Americans misunderstand their own country?
Let me again be careful but emphatic in putting this. Mm-hmm. United States has huge problems right now. That like every other country in the world, it's becoming less equal. That is a global phenomenon. It's an important problem for us. Mm-hmm. But point two, you remember back in the 70s and 80s when crime was actually improving in most cities. Most Americans thought crime was getting worse because the news saturation coverage was all these new urban crimes. So when crime was getting better, most people thought it was becoming more of an emergency. I think something like that phenomenon is happening now, that people, there's a disconnect between the progress many people see in the areas of America they know personally and what they hear about falling apart every place else.
Okay. We hear the big messages coming off the campaign stages, and obviously, in many ways, there's a lot in them that's persuasive. But I am absolutely sure Americans also want to hear what's good going on out there. Tell us about your exploration. When did you begin? Where did you begin? Where did you go? And then we'll judge what you saw.
Okay. So, as you know, my wife Deb and I have been living in China for a number of years. We came back about 5 years ago now. We thought that what had been richest about that experience was taking buses, vans, pirogues, whatever, and going out in the hinterland of China and Southeast Asia and seeing things that were different from the big cities. So we came back to the U.S. when it was still in the post-2008-2009 collapse and thought, what would the U.S. look like if we were applying the same perspective? And for years and years, we've been flying around the country in a little single-engine propeller plane, seeing places you don't see otherwise. So we worked out with the Atlantic the idea that we would spend not all of our time, but a lot of our time going place to place to place and saying, if you're here in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, what's going better, what's going worse? If you're here in Fresno, so we've been now to about 25 places for at least 2 weeks. And another 25 for a couple of days. And we've been all over the place, as far north as Eastport, Maine, as far south as Ajo, Arizona, Plains states, the south, the north, the northwest, and places as hard-pressed as San Bernardino, which is essentially where I grew up. I grew up just across the border in the town of Redlands, and we were there before the shootings. So we've seen places that are in good shape, places that are in bad shape. But overall, the main point I convey is just there's all this stuff going on. You know, it's a nation full of people figuring out how to do the next thing as opposed to a nation full of people sitting around moaning.
Okay. That is enough looking around to buy you some cred. And you're a good journalist. You've been at this for a long time. 2 weeks in a location is long. That's more than parachuting in for a night and talking to a cab driver.
I did my first ever cab driver tweet a while ago. I was so proud.
good you. You're really going places now, Jim. So give us an example of what heartened you, what you found.
So I'll give an example. For any of your listeners who, like me, grew up in California, know that the town of Fresno is sort of the least stylish place in California. It's in the Central Valley.
Yep.
Central Valley, if it were its own state, would be the poorest state in the country. It would be poorer than Mississippi or Arkansas. It has bad pollution from agricultural chemicals. It's been affected by the drought. And Fresno is the capital of the Central Valley in good and bad ways. And it's the bad ways are it has real sort of racial polarization. The downtown is all Latino. The sprawl suburbs are mainly white. It just has any urban problem you want to think of that you associate with Gary or someplace like that you can find in Fresno. Mm-hmm. But over the last couple of years, a liberal Republican woman mayor named Ashley Swearingen has worked with a mainly Latino town, which elects Democratic representatives, to find ways to essentially start have a 20- or 30-year plan for rebuilding the downtown, making it the hub of high-speed rail, of having these junior colleges that will train the children of migrant farm workers for higher-tech farm jobs in the long run. And it just, they all feel as if, the corny way of putting this is, Fresno? No, it's Fres-yes. So Fresno, I've come to think of as a place that's moving in the right direction. They have tech jobs there. I've spent a lot of time in northern Mississippi, which I can tell you about too. But
yes.
So in brief, an area called the Golden Triangle of Mississippi, which are the counties of Lowndes, Clay, and Oktibbeha in north central Mississippi, northeastern Mississippi,
okay.
Is as poor as other parts of Mississippi too. They lost what little factories they had. For example, a toilet seat factory and a headstone factory that contracted for the military.
Mm.
When that went bust, somebody built a house out of disused headstones, which we've seen.
Oh, man. That sounds pretty gloomy.
It is, yes. I think they've come to appreciate the campiness of it.
Okay.
They have become a place where there's the most modern steel mill in northern America is now in this part of Mississippi. Airbus makes its helicopters in northeast Mississippi. And the guy who's been in charge of promoting this essentially told us, you know, when people in Mississippi, they were making stuff, he didn't say stuff, we're making stuff that flies. Suddenly we stood up taller. We thought we can do things because people across the country are well aware of sort of the status hierarchy in the country. And people in Mississippi mm-hmm. know how they are seen and rank, and people in Fresno do too. And so you have, if you ask people in Mississippi, white and black, are things moving forward or back, they would tell you in that part of the town they're moving forward. Now, they've just had a big racial police shooting incident there, which is their sign of the whole local issue. But just one more point, a longtime NAACP leader there, who's now almost 80 years old, was telling me, well, people always stigmatize Mississippi. But when I look around, I see that what the Klan used to do here, the police are doing pretty much every place else. So we're not that bad. So that was
There's so much
his markers for forward movement.
Yeah, there's so much more we want to hear from your on-the-ground observation. In the back of my mind, and I'm sure many listeners as well, it's like, okay, you have got into that little plane and flown to places where things are working. Does that mean that the national assessments of big trouble are wrong? But hold that thought. We want to really dig in there. James Fallows is with us. He is national correspondent for The Atlantic. For the last 3 years, he and his wife, Deborah, have traveled all over the country. It's a little plane and dropping down, and not for 5 minutes either, and finding a lot more resilience, a lot more hope than we hear on the campaign trail. Is there doom and gloom on the campaign trail? You better believe there is. I mean, here's Ted Cruz. This was Ames, Iowa, January.
You know, all of us are here today because our country's in crisis. Because we're bankrupting our kids and grandkids. Because our constitutional rights are under assault each and every day. And because America is receding from leadership in the world.
Yes, it's bad. Here's Marco Rubio.
This is a difficult time in our country. Our economy's flat. It's not creating the jobs it once did. People struggle living paycheck to paycheck. Our culture's in trouble. Wrong is now considered right, and right is considered wrong. And all the things that once held our families together are now under constant assault. And around the world, America's reputation's in decline.
And here was Bernie Sanders. This is Vermont. This was in January. He was responding to former President Bill Clinton, who called him angry while campaigning for Hillary Clinton. Here's Sanders saying he has reason to be angry.
I am angry. And the American people are angry. They are angry that we are the only major country on earth that doesn't guarantee health care to all of our people. They are angry that we have more income and wealth inequality than any other major country on earth. So there is a lot, in fact, to be angry about.
Okay, James, your piece is coming out against quite the wave here. You know, and again, the polls, I mean, people writing into us online as they listen. Ari says, we're approaching the same levels of income inequality as measured by the Gini Index that brought Mao to power. Gilded age with automatic weapons. Neil, we have huge problems. Do not admit this is insanity. Here's another. American resilience. Did you not read about the Deaths among white men, suicide and alcohol poisoning.
So Tom, let me say again, mm-hmm. as I've said in the beginning of every mm-hmm. interchange we've had, mm-hmm. the United States is in a second Gilded Age, and the problems we know about are real. Point one, in contrast to what the Republicans are saying, the United States, compared to the rest of the world, is generally in better shape on these issues than other countries are. As contrary to what Senator Sanders said, our wealth inequality are not as extreme as in China. China's are now more extreme. It's a genuine crisis there. Hmm. Our job creation is too slow, but is faster than any place else. You know, it's a genuine mm-hmm. world Gilded Age crisis now. That is true. Point two, gun violence is a plague here. Our national health system is from any perspective is a problem. Our national politics are paralyzed. So stipulating all of that, which everybody knows and which I've written a million articles about and books about, the news that people don't know is the response that's being generated city by city by city of people deciding there's not going to be an answer to this nationally. It would be better if there were, but there's not going to be. And so what can we do in location X to at least start moving in the right direction?
You quote, Justice Brandeis saying mm-hmm. the states are the laboratories of democracy. Do you see solutions in cities? And these are not the biggest cities. You went to sort of the middle tier cities, yeah. which is good and interesting. Do they have the means, the leverage to create new models for national success?
It becomes a compared to what and plan B type of question. One of the things that struck Deb and me as we were traveling around is how much of even our current architecture, public architecture in 2016, was laid down between about 1933 and 1936 by the WPA. You know, so that when you have a huge national burst of things, you can do things. The interstate highways were a national effort. The farm program has had very strong national research guidance and all of that. It would be better if we had a plan A of some sort of concerted national effort to adapt to this next economic era. Failing that, what I think people are not as aware of from the national media is how much plan B type effort is underway of the connections of people in very separate locations who are figuring out ways, for example, to have a revolution in vocational education. I had not paid any attention to what's now called career technical education, of getting people an alternative to sort of these service sector minimum wage jobs with higher wage skilled technical jobs as repair technicians, as people who run robotic systems, et cetera. The robotics age is coming. People need to repair these things, and you can get $25 an hour for that as opposed to $11. And so that it's the news I'm conveying is that a response is underway a lot of different places.
We have heard a lot of the doom and gloom from politicians. Here's a different kind of perspective. This is Raj Shanak, Vice President at East Mississippi Community College. This is Columbus, Mississippi. They train students for all kinds of jobs, moving out of an older economy into a newer economy. Talking to you, here's Raj.
We have roughly 3,500 students here. When I started working here 20 years ago, we had 350 students. The economy was dying. Now the transformance has occurred, and we have high-skilled, high-wage jobs. So people from making pork chops and making hot dogs are making helicopters and unmanned aircraft, and we are the shining example of Make It in America.
They're out of Columbus, Mississippi. James, do these, I don't know, 1,000 points of light, do they tie together into a national resurgence, or is it good luck to that town that figured it out for itself, but we, you know, big scale, we're still in trouble?
You'll notice how carefully I've avoided using the 1,000 points.
Yes, sorry. There I dump it right on the table.
I'll link instead to Justice Brandeis. I think that the way I end this article, actually, I begin the article talking, quoting a man named Philip Zelikow, who was, I think, is known publicly as the director of the 9/11 Commission. He wrote their report. He's a professor at the University of Virginia. And he said that similar work he has done for the Markle Foundation convinced him that there was a lot of now disconnected illustrations around the country, as there was a century ago, of people figuring out ways to make the most of the opportunities and to limit the damages of this worldwide Gilded Age, and that they're looking for a melody to connect them. And in a sense, what I say at the very end of the piece is that these efforts in thousands of places can become more influential if people recognize they're actually doing similar things, of rebuilding downtowns, of having libraries become maker spaces, of revolutionizing community colleges, of finding ways. One other point, I'm here in Greenville, South Carolina, mm-hmm. which, as your listeners will know, is a very conservative city and a conservative state. I wrote an article comparing it to Burlington, Vermont, Bernie Sanders' original turf as yep. mayor. If you didn't know these two cities were opposites in national politics, you would think they were the same place, because the mayor's office works with the companies, works with the schools, works with the colleges, works with community groups to find ways to make those two cities create more jobs for a wider range of people.
You know, you talk about the Gilded Age a lot. You talk about Paul Starr at Princeton, who we may be talking to soon here on this show, who's written about how Gilded Ages end. And he looks back to the early 20th century when we were in the midst of one and then moved out of it. And he says it's about a pendulum swing of political power reasserting itself over sort of the tyranny of economics over everything. Can the country swing out of its malaise without that kind of swing in power from the economic to the political?
I think we will be better off when we have, again, a functioning national political system. And I quoted last night on the Atlantic's website a really interesting new report by the Kauffman Foundation in Kansas City, in which a friend of mine, whom you may have interviewed, named Bowman Cutter. He was a big budget official both in the Carter and the Clinton administration.
They're all about entrepreneurship there.
Entrepreneurship,
Kauffman.
And that's what Kauffman is about. Mm-hmm. Bo Cutter's piece is essentially applying Edward Bellamy's famous Looking Backward book. In 1888, mm-hmm. Edward Bellamy wrote a book called Looking Backward, 2000 to 1887, about how an imagined history of a better America. And Bo Cutter has done something similar, and his premise is that sometime around 2020, national politics began working again in the United States. So, objectively speaking, the Republican Party is going through the sort of long pendulum swing that started with Barry Goldwater. And we have, if Donald Trump and Ted Cruz are the leading candidates, and they're both sort of nihilistically anti-government, that's a problem for a governing party. That will end at some point. But until that ends, what's the alternative? And the alternative until that ends is something we're describing.
I want to look at more of these examples where you see resilience, because it really is a balm for the ears. But I want to get our listeners in here as well, if I may. Carol, in Austin, Texas, you're on the air with James Fallows. Thank you for calling, Carol.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think too few humans, people here, see beyond their front yard. I think that they're very fat and happy in their ignorant bliss. I'm from the happiest city in the country, Lafayette, Louisiana. I live in the Austin, Texas, which has highest economic growth. You know, we've got a huge boom right now, but I still see the negative happening all around the country with politicians. Our government is horrible. I see a militarized police force. I see our military all over the world. Very, very rich people, and I'm a working poor.
Yeah.
Healthcare. It's just a lot of people don't see beyond that. You know, I love life. I've got a great life. But I see everything that's going on, and I don't see a lot of positive. Really and truly, I don't, and I'm a positive person.
Carol, I appreciate your call. James Fallows, there you have it. I mean, Carol's working poor, she says, but she's living in one of the most economically vibrant cities in the country, Austin, Texas, and still she looks out and sizes it all up and isn't positive.
I will try once again to say, Tom, I think you know, and some of your leaders might, your listeners might, mm-hmm. any problem you want to name in the United States, I've probably written a book about it.
We know.
Who is grappling with its problems of all sorts, starting with race, now economic mm-hmm. inequality, dysfunctional government, police violence, and all the mm-hmm. rest. The point I'm making is that is not the entirety of our situation. When I was living mm-hmm. in China, the point I was trying to get across was, all the news about China is it's a big economic success, and that is part of the story, but it's not the only part, and there's a whole lot of other things going on. For the United States, the problems we are having are not the only part of our current reality, and it deadens us to awareness of where we are in history and what our possibilities are if we are not equally alert to things that are actually finding ways to make some progress. That is the point I'm making.
I don't want to leave you just dangling out there. I mean, to put my cards on the table, I see every reason for this country to be incredibly successful in this century. You know, we reflect the whole world in our demographic makeup. We've got an unbelievable education. We've got unbelievable resources still. As you point out, flying over it, it can look really dingy on a given road, but you fly over this country, we've got space and resources like very few, and still there is so much concern out there. Take us into more locales where you found the resilience at work, James.
So I will talk about Central Oregon. So Central Oregon 15 years ago had the highest unemployment rate in the country. It's because they'd relied for a long time on the timber industry. Timber industry was boom and bust, and the timber, for reasons that some people will blame on regulation and the spotted owl, and others will blame on just the exhaustion of a resource, timber went away. And so when people talked about Flint or Gary or whatever is having hardship, Central Oregon had worse hardship. Now the city of Bend is extremely prosperous, and neighboring places of Prineville and Redmond have found ways to reposition themselves, essentially using their new sense of what their comparative advantage is. Where for city of Prineville, they're trying to make themselves a big data center on the basis of their specifics of their location. Redmond's becoming an aerospace center. Bend has tried to find a way to use something that is an underappreciated resource, which is that real estate is cheap if you're not in the big coastal cities. And so Bend is a pricey place compared to some others. It's way cheap compared to Seattle or San Francisco. They're trying to make themselves a tech hub and sort of a lifestyle hub. It has its inequalities and problems, but it's trying to deal with them. Duluth, Minnesota has had a sort of similar, it was rich 100 years ago. It became very poor as its main industries declined. It's now making itself an aerospace, medical tech, and sort of recreation tech center. And there's all sorts of oddball companies I could tell you about there, but they're places where people are finding what is their particular niche and trying to exploit it.
We're talking with James Fallows. He's flown all over the United States, dropping down for real significant looks at cities that are making it work, talking about sources of American strength, resilience. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. James, what can we take from these locales to the national level that might help us work through the despair and real issues there?
So about 2 weeks ago, I actually had Deb and I were hosting a conference out of the University of Redlands in California, that being my hometown, with mayors of some cities we've seen who are doing interesting things. We had the mayor of Greenville, who are where I am right now, mayor of Duluth, mayor of Dayton, Ohio, mayor of Fresno, California, and the mayor of nearby Riverside. And I asked them, I pushed them on that exact point of what are the ways to extrapolate. One of the most important steps is one of those that is hardest nationally, which is finding some way to move beyond the poison of today's partisan politics, where if person X is for it, you are just axiomatically against it, and where the out party has to say that everything is going to hell. I mean, to have the Republicans say that the military is weak is insane. The United States' military is relatively stronger than it's practically ever been. Moving beyond that is a challenge, but I think the ways in which some local successes in especially technical training, connecting people who might be consigned to no work or to minimum wage food service work, to this middle tier of skilled technical work, which is the new version of the factories we're not going to have anymore. This is essentially the new factory, good-paying factory job. Mm-hmm. That is probably the first place to start, because right now there's not a partisan jihad on one side or the other of that issue.
A place to start right there in a little finer focus, a little finer grain than the big sweeping characterizations you get thrown around on the campaign trail. James Fallows has flown 54,000 miles and sat down in lots of American communities and found sources of American strength, American resilience. He's written it up for The Atlantic in their current issue.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simplest way to create a beautiful website. Whether your passion is bold, unconventional, or just plain crazy, you should share it with the world in an unforgettable way. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint.
Jim Fallows, let me go to Jose calling from not so far from you, Marietta, Georgia. Jose, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. In the early 50s, we were told there were communists infiltrating our government and the army. We were told to build bomb shelters in the backyards. Our children were being shown these little films about what to do in case of a nuclear attack, hide under your desk and all that. And fast forward 50 years later, early 2000s, and now we have a color code for terrorism alerts that a monkey could recognize and know how to respond. I think there are 8 colors, and
I think they may have dropped that. But where are you going here, Jose? What's your point?
Well, what I'm saying is there's always going to be some kind of fear being instilled in the American public. I'm getting these mailings constantly from a family research council that's terrifying in terms of what's happening to our social values of our country. And I'm just saying this never lets up. And, you know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a Democratic president, said we have nothing to fear but fear itself. A Democrat said that. But all this fear-mongering is coming from another side of the political spectrum constantly. We can't escape it.
Jose, I appreciate your call. I mean, let me put up a little sound that may be in some opposition to that. You may not call this fear-mongering, but listen to Bernie Sanders. He certainly says we have very, very significant problems. Here he was right where Jim Fallows is today. This was this Bernie Sanders in Greenville, South Carolina on Sunday.
I could give you a wonderful speech, make it all pleasant and happy and funny, but that's not the world that we are living in. And what I've always believed, that if you do not face up to the difficult problems, you're going to go nowhere in a hurry. The average American is working longer and longer hours for lower wages, while almost all new wealth and income goes to the top 1%. That's a rigged economy.
Bernie Sanders in Greenville, South Carolina, and he's not going to give you all fuzzy, happy speech there. What about national issues that are capping, perhaps, James, the resilience that you see at the local level? What are people bumping up against that does need to be fixed at the national level?
I think they're buffing up against not just a national but a global phenomenon. What Senator Sanders is accurately describing about the United States is happening in every country on earth. Every society is dealing with this pressure for inequalities. Sort of the social democracies of Western Europe have their own tradition in dealing with it, but most places are having these problems even worse than the United States is. So it's a genuine phenomenon that people are trying to... So it would be better if that were not the case globally. It would be better if nationally we had ways to support, for example, the kinds of social safety nets that would make it easier for people to change from job to job to job. One of the points that Paul Starr makes about the first original Gilded Age is that the transition, you couldn't stop the technology that was coming in at that time, but you could have social arrangements that made it less destructive on people to have to make these shifts, started from the labor movement to whatever else. So right now, national policies are lagging, putting too much pressure on localities and organizations and individuals. The news is they are trying to find some of these solutions locally, and it's worth paying attention to that.
The gravity of the national conversation is so strong. I know it will pull us back, but I don't want to lose the local insights that you've pulled up here. You came out here with a list of sort of characteristics or traits of communities that were bucking the darkness here successfully. You've got 10 or 11. If you could just run through the most important of those for us so that people can think about their own communities and whether these would be their own characteristics.
Yes, and so this was a half whimsical list, but actually one I'd actually defend. The number one on the list was that the divisive, poisonous consciousness of politics that so characterizes our national discussion, if that comes up locally, you're in trouble. If it doesn't come up locally, it's much better. And interestingly to us, I'm talking to you from Greenville, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. Most reporters who've been in South Carolina in the last 2 months have been talking about Trump and Cruz and Sanders and Bush and all the rest. In our reports, that generally didn't come up. You know, if you ask people, they would tell you. But this, so having the divisions not coming up is important. Having people who are committed to the long-term welfare of that community, what I'm calling the local patriots, that's something that matters. Having people think there's a civic story. The history of Greenville is this. The history of Sioux Falls is this, and that means its future is going to be that. Whether they're paying a lot of attention to their community colleges and innovative schools, that's something that I thought was really important, because those are ways to connect people who are left out with opportunities that are developing. I also have my whimsical marker of whether there's a craft brewery or a craft distillery, this showing a kind of entrepreneurial presence. And somebody was pointing out to me that a century ago, that was actually true in America's original age of brewing, when brewing was a dispersed local thing and you had lots of pride in local breweries. That went away, but it's coming back.
James Fellows writes, a town that has craft breweries also has a certain kind of entrepreneur and a critical mass of mainly young customers. You may think I'm joking, he says, but just try to find an exception among vibrant communities around the country. The whole piece is up at our website, onpointradio.org, and I highly recommend it to you. Sebastian in Charlotte, North Carolina. Sebastian, you're on with James Fallows.
Hi, Tom. So actually, that's a fantastic point about the craft breweries here in Charlotte, since a lot of them have popped up, and it's
there you go.
Definitely the young crowd. Yeah. Crowd is visible. But I did want to mention, I mean, the whole national gloom does exist, but there's definitely a lot of successes locally as well. Actually, just last night, for instance, there was a very strong LGBT ordinance, anti-discrimination ordinance passed in Charlotte, North Carolina. And about a couple of months ago, it was voted on. It actually failed. So what happened during the municipal elections, a lot of people came out. A lot of the LGBT groups mobilized, and they managed to actually go out and basically elect pro-LGBT proponents, and they managed to get it back on the agenda.
Do you see that as linked to community vibrancy, Sebastian?
I'm sorry?
Do you see that as linked to community health, vibrancy?
Definitely. I think because the demographics are certainly changing. A lot of people are coming down from, like, in New York, New Jersey, and things of that sort. And as the cities are growing, it's becoming more where they're trying to become more inclusive, both in the workplace as well. And certainly these ideas are being expressed more. And at the same time, in places like Huntersville, it's actually the same county, you have the toll roads that were being built because the growth of the city is becoming so rapid.
Sebastian, we've got it. Let me hold it right there and get one more, if I may, from Buffalo, New York. Dan, you're on the air.
Hey. Hi, Tom. Listen, I'm enjoying this, and right now I'm in Buffalo, and I know that we're having a renaissance here, if you will. And while I'm happy to see all that, I remain unemployed with a master's degree. But I look a little bit beyond my own circumstances, and nationally, I wonder about infrastructure, things like water quality, job security, underemployment. There's no security in any of these jobs that they're talking about growing. So I'm wondering what the long-term picture is going to look like. And that's all I'll say, and I'll listen for the answers.
Thanks, Dan. James, I'll give it to you just like that.
Yes, on long-term, the answers on employment security in a new economy have to be national. And at some point, let us hope in the next decade, our national politics will become capable, as it was after the first Gilded Age, of reckoning with this shift. So that is we're in a technological shift. The answers for that have to be national, and let us hope that they come. On the question of the LGBT ordinance in Charlotte, I believe it was, mm-hmm. One of the other things on my checklist is that communities that are strong are ones that consciously make themselves open to immigrants, to people to different races within the U.S., to people from other parts of the country. And you can very strikingly tell towns that go to some efforts to make sure, in a way that the national political debate is not doing right now, that they are inclusive rather than exclusive.
What did it mean to fly on this trip instead of being on the ground? I mean, we've got one listener who says, you know, if Mr. Fallows gets his rear out of his airplane and drive across America, he'll see failed businesses, boarded up storefronts. You say that it's a different perspective when you fly. Compare.
Yeah, people think of flying as getting on one of our airliners and going to like the dozen or maybe 20 airports that get almost all the commercial traffic. When you fly in a little tiny plane, we've been doing at very low altitude, you go to these little tiny airports where most of your listeners have never been unless they're pilots. Number one, you see the incredible shape and historical narrative of the U.S. landscape beneath you, of how much of the eastern third of the country is still forest, et cetera. But also you see places you're just not going to see if you're driving. When you're flying at low altitude, you recognize how little of the U.S. landscape is actually near a road. You know, when you're driving, it seems like it's all road because that's the only place you can go. And when you're flying, you see a little ribbon of road, and then you see this giant expanse on either side of it. So I will submit politely that I've been to a wider range of places than most of your listeners have in the last couple of years, and that's the basis of what I'm saying.
We're talking with James Fallows. His Big Atlantic piece is How America is Putting Itself Back Together. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Bennington, Vermont, and Marta. Marta, you're on the air with James Fallows.
Hello. My main comment is that even in a polluted pond, one can still find live fish. And I think that it does no service to the future of our country to emphasize all of the places that are finding small amounts of success. And Mr. Fallows blithely claims that Europeans are far worse off than we are, but maybe he had better go and visit some of the European cities and towns. And I don't think that he's really being helpful to our election coming up. I think that writing off Bernie Sanders, who is looking at the problems that we are facing and offering us solutions to it, would be much better than backing somebody like Hillary Clinton, who is part of the Democratic machine and is just going to prolong some of the problems that we have today.
Marta, I appreciate your call. James Fallows, writing off Bernie Sanders. And what about Marta says, go to Europe and take a better look.
I am explicitly not connecting what I'm saying to national politics, except excluding Donald Trump, because my point is, as soon as we get into national politics, it's, oh, who are you supporting? What I actually said about Western Europe is that their social democratic safety nets are different from ours and have buffers we don't in Western Germany, for example. But what I did said and will defend is that the pressures of job loss, deindustrialization, all the rest are happening in every society on earth. The United States is in most ways being more resilient in coping with them. And if you go the inequality forces, Germany might be an exception, but the United States is not as grossly unequal as most societies in Asia now, including fast-growing China. So, again, I will match my record of pointing out America's flaws with anyone's. A recognition of the entire picture of America now includes seeing the things that are bad and getting worse and the things that are getting better.
What about, I think Marta is kind of practically saying, kind of suggesting there that her words is not helpful in a way to look at the positive because it may undercut the energy or determination for the changes that even you say may be needed.
Well, we all have, this is a matter of taste.
Mm-hmm.
Me, unrelieved gloom is not helpful either. And I think that this may just be me, but problem and potential solution is to me a more useful way to approach life than problem.
Michael in Akron, Ohio, you're on with James Fallows.
Hello there, Tom.
Hi.
I agree with Mr. Fallows that there's places and pockets throughout America that are doing things to better, you know, our society. But overall, the broad social movements, such as the ones in the 30s that brought way in the 50s for large, more egalitarian and economic sharing of wealth, and the movements in the 60s, which tried to bring about more social harmony and
equality.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, after the, you know, it's pretty much after the early 80s, all that's been eviscerated to some degree, and democratically, there's been a quite concerted effort to shift wealth to the, you know, the top percent. And although, you know, I know that, you know, you don't want to look at the negatives, but unless those things are addressed by broad social movements, we're going to continue being in a society that's split. And And it's not good for people anywhere.
Michael, we're up against the clock here, but I'm very glad for that call. James Fowler, you get yet another swing at that sort of cross currents.
The last one third of my article, which I hope some listeners actually read, mm-hmm. is exactly on this point mm-hmm. of if we're in a second gilded age, what can we learn about the social and political trends that arrested the tensions of the first Gilded Age. So I hope that anyone who thinks I'm just blithely skating past America's problems will read the actual piece.
We have invited on Paul Starr from Princeton, who's writing about how Gilded Ages end, and we'll look at that as well. With all that, James, and we've got all the provisions and provisos there, you say, take some heart. There are real strengths in this country, and let us not ignore them, even as we go at these big questions.
Yes, I think everything that is a problem for the United States now, people are aware of. People are not sufficiently aware of how much is also going on the other side.
How much do you think hinges on the election this year as to whether or not those many points of hope coalesce into something that would turn into a bigger, happier nation?
Stipulating that I'm trying to keep out of national politics, I think the two leading Republican candidates right now, what they think is wrong with America doesn't match what I think is wrong with America, and their solutions also don't match what I think would improve these local efforts. So I hope that Donald Trump in particular is not the 45th president.
Listeners, dive into this piece, and you'll have your own perspective by the time you come out. It is How America is Putting Itself Back Together in the current issue of The Atlantic. The author is James Fallows, 54,000 air miles behind him and still flying. James Fallows, thanks so much for being with us today.
Tom, thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.